Don't send him to Torremolinos. It's not his kind of tundra. Such was the mantra of the Sunday Times when considering assignments for my next guest, Brian Jackman, for whom deserts, rainforests and mountain ranges have always been more enticing habitats. After decades spent travelling and writing about the places, and wildlife that has inspired us, one of the world's most experienced naturalists and explorers has turned his focus on the story of his inspirational life. It is called West with the Light. West with the Light, My Life in Nature. It is by Brian Jackman. Delighted to join me live on the line from the UK, I should imagine, if he's not tromping across the savannah somewhere, is Brian Jackman. Brian, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning to you.
Good to have you with us. Are you somewhere on the High Veldt? Where do we find you today?
No, I'm buried in deepest West Dorset in the southwest of England.
Lovely part of the world to be. Tell me a little bit then. West with the Light. Why the title for your autobiography?
Well, I think ever since I was 1 year old, my father used to work on the Southern Railway. He had privilege tickets where he could take all his family. And so while most of my friends used to go to Bognor or Brighton or Littlehampton, we went all the way down to Cornwall to St Ives. So every year it was West with the Light. When I grew up, that stayed the same when I finally moved west with the light down to where I live now in West Dorset.
So where did the fascination with nature begin? Was it sort of taking those trips? Was it sort of tromping around sort of the West Country that brought home or brought an affinity for you with all natural things?
Oh, everywhere. Back home in Surrey where I live, there was a park at the top of my road which became, as a child, it became my jungle, my savannah. It was filled with birds and butterflies, and ever since I can remember, I've been totally fascinated by wildlife of all sizes and shapes and colours.
So tell me a little bit about how you, because a lot of people are interested in the world around us, the natural world. How did you transform that? How did it become, if you like, a career? How do you take something that you're passionate about and then make, I was going to say a living, but that's not quite the word for it. How do you make it become, one of the defining aspects of your life?
Well, I'd always been good at English at school, terrible at mathematics because I was evacuated during the war. And I lived on a farm for 2 years and never went to school. So my mathematics remains a complete blank in my life. But at the same time, I was reading everything I could, and I developed a love of English and of literature. And eventually, I managed to blag my way into a job on the travel desk of the Sunday Times. And that was in 1970. And that's where it all started. And I discovered then that although the conservation and environment were just bursting onto the scene, it hadn't reached the travel desk, and here was a niche which I could exploit. And nobody else was writing about wildlife and wild places. And all the time I kept on saying, my big love was to go to Africa. I want to go to Africa. And they said, no, you've got to wait. You've got to do other stuff first. But finally, in the end, I got there, and, well, I was so glad, and it was everything I dreamed it would be and more.
I am extremely jealous, because to be working on the Sunday Times in the 70s on the travel desk, or any desk at that point, that was when, if you like, Harold Evans would be the editor at that point, presumably?
Yes, the great Harry Evans. Yes, he was such an inspirational guy to work for. He would always say, okay, guys, we're all going to work our socks off, but we're going to have fun doing it. And so that's what we did. We all went for it. And I'd never gone to university, but the Sunday Times was full of the most amazing, eccentric and wonderful, talented individuals, and it became the university I never went to.
Brilliant. What was it like then, working on the travel desk? Because if you think about it, that period, sort of 1970, say from the mid-60s onwards, we'd had a new thing. We'd had mass tourism. Internationally, I mean, there'd always been, if you like, the bus trips to Bognor, etc. But it was the first time that the public could go away on their package tours to Torremolinos, to Benidorm, to the Greek islands. And what was it like? What did you think when you saw what was happening and the effect that it was having on the places? Because obviously, I'm speaking to you from the Costa del Sol, and this place, you know, we always see pictures of Torremolinos in 1965 when it was the hip place, but it was a tiny fishing village, and now it's been that whole swathe has been hit by, if you like, a tsunami of concrete.
Well, I was lucky, really. The first time I ever went abroad under my own steam, I just got out of the Navy. I'd done national service for 2 years, so I was 21. And my cousin and I, we decided we'd go to the Costa Brava. It was just the name that appealed to us, the Wild Coast. And so this was in 1955, and it was still wild and wonderfully unspoiled. We went down to a village called Rosas. I think it's changed its name to Rosas now, but on the northern end of the Costa Brava. And it was everything I dreamed it was and more. It was just, it just blew me away. And I thought, you know, from now on, travel is going to be a part of my life. And of course, after going on from Spain, my dream was still to go to Africa. And so when mass tourism happened with the jumbo jets, it brought it in terms of price within reach. Although being a travel writer of the Sunday Times, I just had a free ticket to ride anyway.
You talk about you wanting to go to Africa. And so what was it like? Where did you first, if you might, make land on the continent? And what were your experiences? And obviously, was it everything that you had dreamed of?
Well, yes. I'd always wanted to see the big game. Above all, I wanted. I even before I got there, I was a lion fanatic, and so I flew down to Kenya. And as soon as we were there, I said, "Let's get out early and find the cats, you know, before they go flat, before they go to sleep when it gets too hot." And we drove out into the wide open grasslands of Kenya's Masai Mara National Reserve. And it was still cold and bright, early in the morning. And I saw this lion sitting on an anthill about half a mile away. And as he roared, a puff of breath condensed in the air like dragon's breath. And then you heard his voice a second after. So it was puff of breath, puff of breath, whoa! And it full-throated, whoa! And all the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And I thought, how can you not be hooked on big cats for an experience like that? And that did it for me.
I've had several things happen to me on radio shows before, but I've never had a lion impersonation on. So congratulations.
I get a reputation for doing that. You know, there's the wonderful noise of a leopard, which sounds as if it's soaring through a log. And you wake at night in your tent and you hear this, whoa, 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 and it absolutely thrills me to the core.
So what was your brief then? Was it just go out and explore and then also, how did you send copy back? Because obviously we live in an age now where, you know, I bumped into a journalist friend of mine the other day and she was sending a copy back by literally typing on her mobile back to Canary Wharf. So what was the process that you...
In those days, I would just fill a notebook, come back, bring the notebook and write it up. The only time I ever filed a story was when I was sent to report on the murder of Joy Adamson, you know, the Born Free author.
Yeah.
And I turned up at the Sunday Times one day and Harry Evans said, you've heard about what's happened to poor Joy. Do you think you can go down to Nairobi and write the story? And I said, well, Harry, I'm just a travel writer. I'm not a hard newsman. He said, never mind. Can you do it? I went down there, got the story. And afterwards went back to stay with George and saw his lions. So that's the only time I ever filed a story from, you know, the other side of the world.
You mentioned the Adamsons. I mean, you've come across some pretty amazing people during your travels. What were they like? Because they were, again, this is the early days of perhaps people realizing that this is a resource that we need to look after. And people before were sort of thinking that Africa was one giant sort of, if you like, hunter's theme park. And the Addisons were obviously trying to do something about this.
Yeah, George was a marvelous character, and he cared about lions. And he was one of the first. And through the story of Born Free, it brought the whole business into the forefront of everybody. It started, you know, Africa was getting a reputation. Here's this wild land with these fantastic animals. But even then, people were aware that all was not well, that, you know, lions were becoming fewer, elephants were being butchered for their ivory. And we really had to do something about it if we wanted to save the world's last wildlife and wild places. And that's what ecotourism has been doing.
And what's have you run up against opponents to this? I mean, there are governments, there are businesses, there are characters who perhaps don't share your passion or don't share your concerns. I mean, what was it like trying to, if you like, spread the gospel in those very early days?
Well, like pushing a rock uphill, I suppose. But the whole subject is out there now. That's a big thing that has happened.
Tell me a little bit about, I mean, because they're talking about sort of national treasure status. We can't get any further than the great Attenborough. Obviously you must have known of him before you met him, because he seems to have been around since the beginning of time, basically. And I'm sure they'll find him sitting under that, 4,000-year-old, 4,000-year-old tree somewhere in New Zealand at one point. But what was it like? What's it like when you meet somebody like David Attenborough?
Well, he's an awesome and wonderful and incredible, he's one of my great all-time heroes. And in the past, I have written one or two wildlife commentaries for him, which has been a huge honour and a privilege. And in fact, the last time I saw him is sitting under a thorn tree in Kenya with the pride of lions not very far away. And he had the same pale blue shirt that was one of his trademarks. And we spoke over the radios in our Land Rovers. And so there he was, still doing the same thing. It was fantastic.
What is it about Africa? I mean, I'm sitting in this studio now, and the closest I get to Africa is perhaps popping across the Straits and heading down to Marrakesh or something like that, or the Sahara. But what is it about that particular part of Africa that you've made, if you like, if you could step outside from your Dorset home and hit the savannah, then you'd probably want to do that. Why is it the big sky? Is it the big cats? Is it the people? Why does it capture so much imagination of travel writers through the years?
Yeah, the people are wonderful too, in particular the Maasai. But it's abundance of wildlife. It's variety of wildlife, abundance in terms of a million wildebeest on the march, variety into thousands of bird species. And then above all, perhaps, it's space. I mean, of the savannah reaching out to the ends of the world, you look as though you can see the edge of the world turning in space to meet the rising sun, and nothing but grass and the horned heads of animals poking out. It's just, there's nothing like it anywhere else. Wonderful though Europe is, and I absolutely love Europe, and I spent so many good times walking over the Pyrenees fantastic experience. But in the end, it's Africa that does it for me.
And presumably it's Africa, as you said at the beginning of the interview, Africa in the early, as the dawn comes up and everybody's still active before the sun sort of beats the life out of everything.
That's right. It's a good time to be early on, and then you can, like the animals, you take a siesta in the middle of the day, everything is hot, and then around 4 o'clock, the light gets golden, the air is a bit cooler, you have what you call the golden hour just before sunset, and that's when all the cheetahs stretch and get up and go hunting, and you see everything happening again before you go back for a shower at a sundowner and then listen to the animals and listen to the lions roaring at night as you lie in your tent. Fabulous experience.
Did the Times travel desk let you basically set your own agenda, or were you sometimes told, we want you to go off to some of the perhaps less desirable locations or places that you made you sort of think once or twice before going out there?
Oh yeah, first of all, I just had to go where I was told, but as I got my feet under the desk, and in the end I could pretty well set my own agenda.
And what was you mentioned trekking across the Pyrenees, and we are in Spain, but what would have been your favorite experiences in Europe perhaps?
Well, that was one of the Pyrenees was certainly one area which I absolutely loved, and one of the nicest things about it is if you love the European springtime, as you climb through the Pyrenees, the higher you go, you're even in summer, you're still catching back, but still higher up, you still hit springtime. And so it's a way of extending the wonderful European spring.
You were an advocate of of ecotourism before it even was a thing. Well, I mean, you must look back and, you know, there are still several cases to be concerned at, the several issues we still have to be concerned at, you know, trophy hunting, people who, you know, that's been a major thing. Do you think that with the advent of social media and more young people becoming concerned about what's happening with the environment and the mainly you'd say now a wild scale abhorrence of people who big game hunt, is that perhaps one of the positive things that you've seen coming out in your time in Africa and with the ecotourism?
Yes, I'm sure it is. I find it it's completely beyond my understanding why anybody would want to shoot a lion, let alone an elephant, a giraffe. I mean, if you shoot an elephant, it's 5 tons of animal, and he's just gone. One thing which occurred to me was I was on safari with Jonathan Scott, the wildlife cameraman, photographer, buddy, and we just finished a safari in the bush. We were sitting in the tent, and one of the tent staff came in and said, Bwana, there's Simba in the camp. A lion is in the tent. So Jonathan picked up one of these wooden chairs and walked out. And I thought, well, I can't let him go on his own. So I picked up a chair. And just outside the tent, a few yards from us, was a big male, full-on male lion. We knew who he was. He was called Brando because he had a shaggy Brando-style haircut. He was one of the Maasai, the Marsh Pride males. And we stood, there was a standoff, us with our canvas-back chairs and him with his mane and his teeth and his claws. And we looked at each other, and he was only about 3 or 4 yards away. And in the end, he just went woof. And he trotted off. And I thought, well, okay, if you're a trophy hunter, if you want to get an adrenaline rush, leave your rifle at home and try and confront a lion with a camp chair and see what that does for you.
Absolutely, and several changes of underwear, I'd imagine, afterwards as well.
What's that?
And several changes of clothing afterwards as well, with a shock of that. Why did you decide that you wanted to write this now? Was it because of the situation that we've all been in terms of not being able to travel anywhere over the past sort of year, 16 months?
Yeah, this is why I couldn't go to Africa for a whole year, so I was sitting here pining, and two things happened. One, and I said, as I sit here looking out of my window, and there's outside my window, there's a walnut tree, which looks like an African leadwood tree. And I said, I can almost imagine a leopard lying in it. And sure enough, she went and made me a full-size leopard out of chicken wire and an old shower curtain, and it's hanging out in the tree right as I speak. But the other thing, more importantly, is I had a whole year in which to sit down and write my autobiography. And it seemed to make a very good final payoff that the COVID had changed things. And here, when we first had the lockdown here in Dorset, I was aware of this kind of ancient field sense of ancient silence with no planes, no cars, no, and the sky was clear. And I swore I could smell the Atlantic, even though it's 100 miles down the road. And this was a sort of payoff time, and yet at the same time, the swallows were coming back, the butterflies were emerging, and nature was still doing its own thing in spite of everything that was happening to us.
That's one of the things. I was lucky enough to be able to, because this is the first time in my life I was judged to be an essential worker. I was allowed to travel, but there was nothing else on the roads, and I would park in the car park outside the studio here, and normally there's a very busy main road, but there's nothing on the road, so you would absolutely hear, and it seemed like nature was putting on a command performance, because it was like, right, there's no background noise, here we go, chaps.
That's right. Even here at night, the stars were so bright, they reminded me of sleeping out in the Kalahari. There was no pollution. The skies were dazzling. It's all changed a bit now, but we saw how it was for a spell during lockdown.
Indeed, the smells like the Kalahari. You must be itching to get back to Africa then. Is that the first on your list as the restrictions come down?
Yeah, I can't wait to get into a Land Cruiser and drive out into that great grass oceans, and then pitch up at dark time, in a green canvas tent, and line my and let hear that sound again of the lion. Ooh, that groan, which finishes up with this code. You know, when they roar, and then, ooh, and at the end, there's always this code of, ooh, 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 and you're just lying. I just think it is fantastic.
That's pretty much like me before coffee in the morning, but Brian, I'll have you with that one. If you were to take a single memory or a single experience then for our listeners, before they rush out and buy the book, obviously, is it that pre-dawn, that dawn light, or the sound that we've got somebody come in saying Africa makes you feel humble and really connect to life. It makes this is from Claudia. Africa makes you feel humble and really connect with life. It makes you understand that we really are part of nature. And she said she's also had a few brown pants situations in the bush with lions and elephants.
When we think of lions and elephants, one of the sounds which immediately summons up Africa for me is the sort of dawn chorus when you have about a million Cape turtle doves and they're all going... That's just me, but if you imagine that a million times, and that's what you wake up to in Africa, and then you get out there in the sun and the wind and you live like a lion, it's wonderful.
The book is called West with the Lights, my life in nature. It's by Brian Jackman. Brian, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you have a website? Do you do that social media thing? Is there an online presence?
Well, if Google up my name, is out there somewhere, I'm sure. We just track it down.
I think there's more interesting things to track down, especially in the African bush. The book is called West with the Light. It's by Brian Jackman, who we've been speaking to. Brian, thank you so much for your time today. Congratulations on your first Zoom meeting, by the way. I'm very impressed.
Thank you.
And we must give kudos to your dear lady wife. And can I honestly say, I've never had so many spot-on impersonations in an interview before.
Well, I can say to you in Swahili, Nashukuru, I'm grateful. And tutu anana tena. See you again, I hope. Take care now.
Nashukuru as well. Brian Jackman, thank you so much for your time today.